Welcome to the Centre for Public Integrity's podcast series. The Centre is Australia's leading democracy research institute. In these podcasts, we aim to bring to listeners the key decision makers and policy designers around the country discussing just how our democracy works. I'm Michael Barker, former federal court judge and a director at the Centre, and today I'm very pleased to welcome Helen Haynes, member for INDI in the federal parliament. Welcome, Helen.
Thank you very much, Michael. I'm delighted to have the opportunity to have a chat with you this afternoon, and thank you to the Centre for Public Integrity. I'm a great admirer of your organisation, and I've had the great privilege of working with you closely on a lot of things in the federal parliament since I've been the member for INDI.
Well, somebody said to me earlier today, Helen, who's your next podcast with Michael? And I said, it's Helen Haynes. And they said, now what's her electorate? And I said, it's INDI. I said, that's an unusual name. How do you spell that? And I spelt it. And I said, it sounds like Indy. Is she an independent?
Yeah, it was as if the it's a federation seat, of course, Michael. So
Sir Isaac Isaacs.
Perhaps constitutionally we were always meant to be independent. I'm very proud that we are, and very proud that this dynamic community independent movement that's taken root across the nation found its beginnings here in INDI in 2013 when we elected Cathy McGowan as the first independent member for INDI.
I wanted to raise that because really you've been the epicentre in INDI of the community candidate, Cathy McGowan, and all those years. Now you for a couple of terms. What was it in the water of democracy, we might say, at the time and since, Helen? Have you been able to put your finger in and guess?
Maybe there is something in the water. Of course, the electorate of INDI contributes more than 50% of the water into the Murray-Darling Basin, Michael, so water is very important to us. We're a very significant catchment. But I think it's also important to remember that INDI is also the home of Ned Kelly, who was something of a revolutionary, of course, one of our villains or heroes, depending which way you interpret Australian history. It's a gold rush community too, so perhaps INDI has always had something in its blood and in its waters that mean that people like to engage in their democracy and are willing to roll up their sleeves and do something about it.
The community candidate process, Helen, is really interesting when you are discussing how democracies work. On the one hand, you can have well-established parties, as many countries do, and Australia has, and they, in their own organs, develop policies and say they're going to realise those if elected, and then they, if they get elected, set about it. They don't always achieve everything they want to achieve or say they'll achieve. The role of the independent candidate, though, the question is how do they get their policy platforms? How's it generated?
Yeah, it's a great question, Michael. And of course, I think what the community independent movement has done is provide a very credible third way when it comes to choice on a ballot paper. For such a long time, we've had the two major parties competing for primary votes across Australia. And if someone felt that there wasn't something for them in a major party platform, they had to look elsewhere for somewhere to plant their vote, and there wasn't that many places they could go. Perhaps extreme candidates or very niche micro parties. But the community independent movement has come, you know, it's what it says on the can. It's come from the community. And certainly in my case in INDI, it was a group of individuals, 12 of them in fact, who got together to say, surely we can do better than this, and started a process called the Kitchen Table Conversation, which grew from the Victorian Women's Trust process in Victoria, and from the Purple Sage Project, which of course was instrumental in changing the outcome of the state election when Jeff Kennett was Premier. So we adapted that methodology under really good guidance from the Victorian Women's Trust. And in that process, there were some clear directions coming from the community about how they wanted federal representation to look for them. And some of it was quite straight up. It was around having representation where the federal member showed up, where they participated in community events, where they listened to people frequently across the small villages and bigger regional towns. So that was kind of the baseline ask. But for me, this is my second term as a parliamentarian, so running for election again. As I like to say, I'm worn in, not worn out, so I'm asking the people of Indi to consider me for a third term. I always campaign on a solid evidence-based policy platform, and I get those policy ideas. And ultimately, a policy really is a solution to a problem, isn't it? So I listen very carefully out in the community. I take meetings with my constituents. I run small groups. We have forums. I have advisory groups. And we identify what the problem is we're trying to solve, and then we come forward with solutions that we can take in, or that I can take into the parliament. And I think one example of an issue that was particularly problematic for the people of Indi was the very, very poor quality of our telecommunications. And we know that in modern life, reliable telecommunications are essentially a human right now. There's almost no business transaction you can undertake without reliable telecommunications, emergency services. You know, we have people who couldn't dial 000 because there were so many mobile phone black spots. We're one of the highest risk bushfire areas in the world. This was really problematic. Young people couldn't engage in education, couldn't access the internet. The list goes on with the problems that we have experienced. And some of that is because of our topography, Michael. Indi, northeast Victoria, from Kinglake to Corryong, big towns of Wodonga and Wangaratta, Benalla, Mansfield, but lots of mountains. It's all the alpine area. So we set about trying to solve this problem that we identified, and both Cathy and I have worked very hard on telecommunications and taken that into the federal parliament. I've introduced private members legislation around this, around the universal services obligation. We've worked together in pursuing funding opportunities for mobile phone base stations and the like, and at the most recent rural and regional telecommunications review, I brought that review committee down into Indi. 150 local people came and met with the committee. I put in detailed submissions, and that's one way of how we develop policy in Indi. Similarly, when it comes to energy and power and climate change, worked co-designed with the community something called the Local Power Plan, introduced private members legislation, and have advocated very strongly for local solutions to our energy needs.
Helen, you make it sound so easy and seamless. It must have its challenges, though, being a community candidate. If you are in a major party, they can send you down their energy policy or where they stand on climate change or telecommunications. Are there challenges for the community independent?
Oh, too right there are. Of course, if you're an independent, you don't have the full backing of a significant powerhouse of a party with all of their policy support and administrative support. Of course, if you're a member of parliament who's in government at the time, you've got all the departmental support that comes with that. An independent has to work outside of that process or outside of that kind of support. We have a very small team in our office to work with. But I think what I do, and I observe my colleagues on the crossbench do it as well, is that we harness the full power of the parliamentary tools. So I certainly made it my business when I first became a member of parliament to truly understand how the parliament works, what kind of tools are available, things like motion debates, questions without notice, questions with notice, committee work, how to use the parliamentary library, how to formulate policy by working with civil society groups like yourselves, the Centre for Public Integrity, who, of course, I work very, very closely with on the development of the Integrity Commission. How to cost policies through the Parliamentary Budget Office. So it's a lot of work, Michael. It truly is. But I think when it comes to ground truthing that, when talking to community with those fully fledged policies, it literally has come from them, essentially. So I think that ultimately it makes sense to people when you step out into the community and say, here's the problem that we've collectively described, and here now is a suite of solutions that we can take to the Parliament.
Helen, there must have been a point, I'm accepting it might have been when you were in the womb or a small child, where you developed your own set of values about how government should work, what it should look like, what a proper government does.
Well, I don't know that I did. I mean, I think like most people, Michael, of course I'm shaped by the hands that nurtured me as a small child and educated me and my life experience. And I was a pretty latecomer to politics. I had 30-odd years working in healthcare before I reluctantly accepted an invitation to put my hand up as a candidate, as a community independent candidate in Indi. I mean, it wasn't a position I ever sought, to be perfectly frank. And while I keenly observed politics from the cheap seats all of my life, of course, I judged what policies and what solutions various brands of government put to us based on, again, my life experience. And, I grew up on a farm. I understand the cycles of the seasons. I understand the difficulty of hard physical work. It was a dairy farm. It was really hard work. I had four brothers and, I understood the contest of ideas very early on, around a kitchen table where everyone seemed to have an opinion. My grandfather was secretary of the local branch of the Country Party. So, those kind of old Country Party views were well and truly held by my family. I was educated by Mercy nuns who had a particular worldview. But ultimately, for me, my life was always going to be around what I perceived as doing something in public service, doing something that I considered kind of to have some value to making the world a better place, which sounds pretty corny, but that was what drove me, and it still does, to be honest. I think there's real opportunity in public life, in that very, very privileged position as a Member of Parliament to do something good.
Helen, I've never made a close study, just mere impressionistic observations from a distance, about the people who get into politics. You're a little older. I've been speaking to people who have come with maturity to a political life. There are, of course, those from around the country who have, in the olden days, mostly men, who at a young age, in their 20s, found themselves in Parliament, and one would have thought without a terrible lot of life experience. Is there some magic formula to who ought to be allowed to run for Parliament?
Well, I guess we shouldn't have... there are a few rules, aren't there, Michael, about who is allowed to run for Parliament, and we explored that a few years ago under Section 44. But, of course, I guess the obvious thing is we really need to have a Parliament that reflects the people, so we need to have diversity in the Parliament, both gender mix, ethnicity, life experience, and... as I said before, I started my life, I've spent most of my life working in healthcare. I started out as a nurse and then a midwife, and then I took studies in public health and ultimately a doctorate in medical science. And I bring all of that life experience and I guess way of thinking and way of solving problems into the Parliament. And I love it when I'm in a committee with people who come from a whole variety of perspectives and standpoints, and I observe them keenly about how they go about dissecting a problem and constructing a solution. And I'm always learning from my colleagues in the Parliament, and mostly, though, I actually learn from people in the community. When I'm not in Parliament, I'm out on the road in tiny organisations and larger organisations. I meet with people from all walks of life, and it's actually a real joy to me to see the world through a different sets of eyes. It makes me really reflect on my own approach to things, and at times we can jump to a solution very quickly. Back in the days when I was a young nurse, there was a theory about from novice to expert and the various steps that you take in reaching a clinical diagnosis. And of course, when you're very young and inexperienced, you follow many steps. As you get older, you apply your experience very quickly, but you can make mistakes in doing that. So I think the Parliament should reflect this, and it's why I think there are some improvements we can make to our parliamentary process that would enable a greater diversity in our debating process and in our decision-making in Parliament.
Well, tell me more about that. I'm really interested in what sort of improvements could be made.
Well, the first one that strikes me as really important and something that I would argue vociferously for, and that's around the capacity for private members' bills to be debated and voted on in the Parliament. I would say that as a member of the crossbench and a member who puts forward many private members' bills into the Parliament, and of course the government controls the agenda. And the government never allows a private member's bill to be debated. But when we think about some of the big reforms that could take the country to a better place, those reforms often come from the courage of the crossbench, who are not dictated to by a large party with a whole lot of vested interests. So, again, if I were to take us to the example of the National Anti-Corruption Commission, which ultimately was legislated at the beginning of this 47th Parliament.
You introduced that bill.
We would not have got to that place, I don't think, if it were not for the private members' bills put to the Parliament preceding that. And we could have got there a lot faster, Michael, if the Parliament had a chance to debate that legislation. And again, it would, I think, encourage members of Parliament to be much better at working across the aisles and garnering collaboration and votes from both sides in order to move an idea forward.
Helen, you've mentioned in a number of contexts the introduction of private members' bills. Another one which, in a sense, was a big ticket item, a really important issue in the populace at large, was the end pork barrelling bill. Tell us about that and how you became involved in wanting to end pork barrelling. I mean, it's a bit of a Dorothy Dixer, I know.
Well, you know what, Michael? I'm seen as a bit of a spoil sport on this one. This desire of mine to stamp out what I know to be an egregious misuse of taxpayer money in political parties using public funds in order to influence voting and to gain advantage for themselves rather than for the public in general. Is something that really sticks in my craw. I mean, we have limited funds in this country, of course we do, and any government who has the trust of the people to be in charge of the Treasury needs to exercise great judgment and extreme care in how money's invested. So when I see major parties, particularly at election time, almost entirely at election time, making grand announcements on infrastructure mostly, in order to curry favour in a particular seat, usually a marginal seat or a must-win seat or a must-hold-on-to seat, we know that there's a project of perhaps better merit or at least equal merit that doesn't receive any funding. So I think it's an appalling misuse of funds, and it undermines trust in government. And when you undermine trust, you subsequently undermine the capacity of any government to lead and bring about important change. So I think it's part of the integrity jigsaw that still has a very significant missing piece. I know that, of course, the New South Wales ICAC did an inquiry into pork barrelling and determined that it is, in fact, corruption. So I think it needs to be stamped out, and I feel so seriously about that that, again, I drafted legislation and introduced it to the House and have made the case. I've invited every member of Parliament and every senator to meet with me to talk about it. Not many people wish to. Most people get very angry when I suggest that we should no longer continue with this practice. So it's not a popular idea in the Parliament amongst the major parties, but my colleagues on the crossbench have been quite united in support of my quest to do something about this. It's interesting, Michael, like it's so ingrained in the public mind that I find myself having to give many lecture series out out in my own electorate to people who come and see me and think that decisions will be made according to, you know, a bit of a wink and a nudge and a quiet conversation with a person in power. And I really do try to move them to another way of thinking. And I think particularly in rural and regional Australia where we've got some significant gaps in our infrastructure, I spoke earlier about telecommunications. My approach to this is that we need to increase the amount of funding to critical infrastructure and have a very robust competitive system which is merit-based. I mean, that's hardly a radical idea. So I think that if in fact people understood that it was a fair and level playing ground, then they would be more inclined to do the substantive amount of work that it is to put in a detailed application for funding.
The West Australian government some years ago was pushed and agreed to come up with a royalties for regions program, which was not unlike what you've just described. It meant there was a more scientific basis to the allocation of funds that were used for improving towns, for building roads, for putting in fishing harbours, you name it, around the state. It takes away the personal discretionary allocation of funds by a minister.
Indeed, absolutely. And I just know that we'd all benefit from this. So I'll continue on my campaign to try to do something about this. And again, I'm not suggesting in any way that there shouldn't ever be an opportunity for a minister to disagree with departmental advice. There may well be good reason to do that. And you know, one example would be in an emergency situation that, you know, there may be very strong reasons why a minister might say that funds need to go to a particular place outside of the regular recommendation from a department. But, in such a case, the minister should, with no shame whatsoever, come into the Parliament and make that transparent in the Parliament. That's what I seek, is processes that would enable that to happen.
Helen, when you came in back in 19, there were a number of integrity issues before us, and one of the big things for you and other so-called Teals at the time who were elected was to have an integrity commission brought into the Commonwealth sphere. And as you've mentioned, you succeeded. And I imagine that on its own must have been a tremendous learning experience about how you can go about parliamentary business and achieve things. What else was achieved during that first term? And what about this term just gone? How do you measure your successes during this period? And what remains?
So I think in the previous term, I touched on before this conversation that was happening across my electorate around energy security and the energy commons, I suppose, around communities' capacity to generate, store and share electricity. Like many things in rural and regional Australia, we come up with innovative ideas based on necessity. And some of my communities, Michael, are on the edge of the grid. We have all sorts of problems with blackouts and brownouts. We have, as I mentioned before, communities that live in very high-risk bushfire areas. And we have communities who are really concerned about playing their role in reducing emissions and finding different ways to lead a high-quality and productive life. And not to be using fossil fuels to generate their energy. So We've had the highest number of what we call community energy groups of anywhere in Australia, and these groups have been doing things from bulk buys on heat pumps, split system, air conditioning and cooling units through to solar panels, batteries, and indeed even little microgrid development. So I worked with these groups across Indi and put out a discussion paper to the nation, and then co-designed some policies around how we could expand this and make greater use of this, knowing that we had real challenges on our grid and we have real challenges in reducing our use of fossil fuels, and how could we generate the power of the people, and how could we also share the benefits of producing renewable energy in rural and regional Australia. So I introduced, again, private members legislation to set up a standalone agency for local power. I wasn't successful in doing that. In fact, there wasn't much I was successful at all on in terms of getting a tangible, touchable outcome, but I started to change the conversation. One of the things that has changed since then is a greater understanding of energy storage on a domestic level. We're seeing far more policy work now around home electrification, about no interest loan schemes. I want to see more on that so that local people can generate and store their energy. I was successful in getting around $8 million during the last Parliament into one of our small communities, a little town called Corryong, right up on the top of the Murray River that lost its power for a couple of weeks in the Black Summer bushfires. And we then had co-investment from the state government. We've got a $20 million project up there to create a microgrid in that town, which will make it fully islandable when the next blackout happens, so that a series of solar panels, batteries and diesel generators can be flicked on and off the grid, and that town can then power 900 homes and businesses, the hospital, police station, schools and so on, and keep the lights on. So that's been a real success, and I want to see that replicated in other places. I think this Parliament, just again thinking about the impact of climate change in rural and regional communities, one of the areas where my communities, particularly my farming communities, I had heard from them loud and clear. I had meetings with local farmers and they said, we need assistance in navigating what are now really complex ideas and policies around things like carbon markets and ways that we can lower our emissions, as we know we need to, but harness the opportunities of climate change and renewable energy and opportunities to increase our soil productivity through carbon sequestration and so on. And I argued that we should have essentially what used to be extension offices in primary industries. I campaigned very hard and was successful in convincing the government to establish the Sustainable Agricultural Facilitators, SAFs, got funding in the budget for that, and they're now rolling out right across Australia to be that link, neutral, trusted, informed information source for farmers as we transition into a very, very different world.
Helen, the committee system within the Parliament generally, I must say I find really interesting, great set of levers there in a sense for trying to make democracy work. The Senate, in one sense, has been set up to do it almost, but the committee system was introduced at some point in time and it operates in the lower house, and there are joint committees. What's your take on committees? And you, of course, are helping to run one.
Yes, indeed. I was really excited about being part of the committee system, Michael. In the first Parliament, I chose a couple of committees that I'd nominated myself for that would have direct relevance to my community. One was essentially the Regional Australia Committee. It's Regional Roads Infrastructure Transport kind of committee. The other one was on telecommunications in the NBN. And this Parliament, similarly, I'm on the Regional Committee, but I'm also on the Parliamentary Joint Committee of the National Anti-Corruption Commission, so oversight of the NAC. Part of my frustration with committees is that by nature I am I go into my committees very well prepared. I read my papers. I engage my community to put in submissions to our committee work. I bring committees to my electorate so that people have got the opportunity to be witnesses, and I engage very, very energetically with report writing and recommendations. My frustration slash at times exasperation is that some of this committee work, which, you know, we've engaged the Australian people in good faith on, languishes for way too long before government respond. And even when they do respond, they often either don't act or very slowly act on some of the recommendations. And I think that's really disappointing because a high-functioning committee with really good members can produce some, I think, very important work, very important work that can improve public policy. So I've been a bit disappointed in that from both governments, and one of the things I would seek to change should I have the opportunity would be that there was some tighter rules around how quickly a government must respond to recommendations of a committee report. I think the other thing that I've learnt, and, you know, as a newcomer to the Parliament, this is just my second term, but certainly my first term, it became very apparent to me just the power of the government, of course, in having the numbers and the chair. So if you go into those committees with an open mind and a desire to bring about change, you are quite constrained by the fact that the government ultimately controls the committee. I would love to see a committee process that actually had did not necessarily have a government chair, or at the very least had had a crossbench person like myself as chair or co-chair or deputy chair. And in fact, I was able to achieve that on the National Anti-Corruption Commission. Very pleased to be deputy chair.
In the next phase, assuming the electoral cycle works as you would want it to, in the next parliament, what's the unfinished business from your point of view?
Oh, I've got plenty, Michael. We've talked a lot about integrity in our conversation today, and you and I both know how hard fought it was to have robust legislation to underpin the very, very first National Anti-Corruption Commission. And much of that legislation is excellent and working well. Some of it maybe not working so well. The area that I think remains, I guess, a thorn in my side is the public's capacity to truly trust in this process by their ability to see what's going on. And one of the, I think, the clear fault lines to me in the legislation for the National Anti-Corruption Commission was the last-minute insertion of that clause in regard to public hearings, which added the term exceptional circumstances when the commission is determining whether a public hearing should be held and whether it was in the public interest, which was, I think, a very high bar anyway, but adding to that bar a higher bar and in exceptional circumstances, which were not defined. So I feel my work is unfinished there. I did try to amend that legislation in the House of Representatives at the time. I was unsuccessful to knock out the exceptional circumstances clause, was successful in arguing in the committee process to have strong powers of the inspector, which is in fact shown to be a very, very good thing indeed. We've seen the role of the inspector exercised robustly in recent times. But I think that the National Anti-Corruption Commission would be strengthened by an amendment to the legislation to remove the exceptional circumstances clause for a public hearing.
Well, the Centre for Public Integrity advocated for that outcome at the time the legislation was going through, and I must say that I think that remains our position too.
Well, perhaps Michael, I would say though, while that work that I undertake on integrity is something that has an enormous impact for the entire nation. There's other elements, of course, in the integrity portfolio, like whistleblower reform, that remains unfinished business, and yes. I'm committed to continue my advocacy in that space. And outside of the integrity area, for me, I represent a rural and regional electorate, and I believe that that government of multiple persuasions really fails to embrace the opportunity that is there in rural and regional Australia. There's a blind spot at times in many policies, and I've amended several significant acts of Parliament to include the words rural and regional Australia so that there is context-specific policies that address both the challenges and the opportunity in the regions. And right now, of course, like many parts of metropolitan Australia, rural and regional Australia is facing enormous challenges with housing. And I want to see fair distribution of funds into rural and regional Australia from these big funds like the Housing Australia Future Fund, multi-billion dollar funds, similarly with some of the Future Made in Australia funds. I want to make sure that rural and regional Australia gets its fair share of those kind of national investments.
Well, after all, government is carried on for all the people of Australia, and there's a trust in it all that has to be reflected in what decisions people make. Cathy, we're starting to come towards the end of this discussion. I'm really fascinated. You've been there now nearly two terms. Along the way, were there things that sort of took your breath away, you were surprised about, you thought, surely this can't be the case? Someone who wasn't a politician before they got elected one?
Oh, look, there's, I guess the first surprise for me was that I became a member of Parliament, Michael. So for me, sitting in my seat as the member for Indi was not a life trajectory that I saw coming until it did. And for me, that absolutely took my breath away, the privilege of that opportunity. In this parliament, there's 151 seats, and the next there'll be 150. To be one of those rare Australians that takes up a seat in the Australian parliament is a breathtaking moment, and one that, I just don't waste a minute in this job, because I just think when people give you their trust to represent them, you need to do that faithfully and honestly and with enormous amount of hard work. So I guess that was the first breathtaking moment to find myself there. I suppose the second breathtaking moment was indeed some of the less than parliamentary behaviour that I observed, and coming from the world that I came from, I was appalled that there was no code of conduct and the work that subsequently has happened, and I think this is a significant achievement in this parliament post the Jenkins review, that we have moved the dial on codes of conduct and behaviour more broadly in the parliament. We still see some very unparliamentary behaviour at question time, but most keen observers and listeners to this podcast would know that much of that is highly performative. But I think that most certainly what I saw not only in the chamber but in the corridors did take my breath away, and I was truly shocked by that. Some of the courage I've seen in the parliament is breathtaking too, and I've seen people share very personal details of their lives in ways that take enormous amount of courage. And I've seen, I've seen one member of Parliament, my good friend Bridget Archer, exercise great moral clarity and enormous courage to cross the floor on some deeply important legislation that has had a significant impact, I think, on the way Australia views parliamentarians. I think they've seen Bridget and thought, yeah, there's hope in the major parties when there's someone like that who's willing to cross the floor and make a decision based on her moral judgment. The day that Bridget supported me in the parliament on my legislation for the Integrity Commission and seconded my motion, much to the shock of the House, and that was a moment that truly took my breath away in the last Parliament. And I think, I guess the humility and the wisdom and sorrow that I've seen from some of my colleagues in the parliament, particularly Linda Burney, after the referendum was also a moment that gave me pause to sigh deeply and admire her grace and humility as an Aboriginal woman and a very senior member of parliament.
Helen, there's a lot said about how the public are distrustful of politicians, which derives, of course, from the practice of politics. But from everything you've been telling me, there'd be no reason why a mother wouldn't encourage her daughter to go into politics and help to boost trust in the whole democracy process. Do you agree?
Well, absolutely. Mothers should encourage their daughters to aim for public life, to pursue an opportunity to serve the public through something like being a member of parliament. There's many ways you can serve the public. Yeah, I mean, look, you serve the public yourself, Michael. Parliamentary life is one way. But again, I think you can shape the world that you walk into. And I think that no one should hesitate to take up an invitation if one comes your way. If there's an opportunity to put yourself forward to run for parliament, I would absolutely encourage people to do that. And if you are fortunate enough to get there, to not be afraid to use your position to ask questions of your colleagues and ask questions of the system. And in fact, that's what you should do. That can come at a personal cost. Of course it can. But I think if we go back to our earlier discussion about having a parliament that comprises of people with a wide variety of life experiences, people who've had jobs for a long time outside of parliament, then, you know, you can bring that thinking into the place. So, I would say to any mother or father who is guiding a young person through life that they if they think that politicians aren't what they hope they should be, then you need to be the change that you want to see ultimately.
Helen Haynes, thank you very much for joining me on this podcast today.
Lovely to speak with you, Michael. Thank you so much for the chance. Bye-bye now.